Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. I'm Allison Kaplan Summer. On today's show, so it's been a week of big changes across Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. The most obvious change for Haaretz podcast listeners is the fact that they can surely tell that I am not Simon Spungen. I'm Allison Kaplan Summer. I'll be filling in for Simon for a while, who is on a well-earned extended vacation. But that is the least of the big changes these days. We are counting down the final days of the Trump White House, the end of the harmonious bromance between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, making Israelis nervous about what will come next for the Israel-U.S. relationship. As Trump continues to fight publicly, if unsuccessfully, against what he says is a rigged election process, he thinks he really won, and the rest of the world says he faced a clear defeat. Meanwhile, Joe Biden has begun to put together his administration and, most importantly for Israel, his foreign policy team. As if this weren't all changey enough, into the mix came the big breaking news on Friday from Iran's defense ministry. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the father of Iran's military nuclear efforts, was killed in a mysterious shootout. Israel has said nothing about it, but the New York Times cited three intelligence officials as saying that Israel was behind what was clearly a targeted assassination. And an unnamed senior Israeli official told the Times that the world should thank Israel for killing Fakhrizadeh. The next day, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei called for punishing those behind the killing, which is just the latest action taken against Iranians on Iranian soil under mysterious circumstances. And word on the Iranian street is that it's time to send a signal that they are mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. The Israeli media, as a result, has been full of speculation as to what shape retaliation might take. Here to help us sort out all these changes are Amir Tibon, a senior editor and journalist at Haaretz, a former Washington, D.C. and diplomatic correspondent. And for those of you Anglophiles and fans of The Crown who are missing Simon's accent, we've got Esther Solomon, Haaretz's opinions editor. Is there any chance that the timing of this assassination in Iran, coming at the time of Donald Trump's transition and Biden's anticipated entrance into the White House, a mere coincidence? And if one assumes that it wasn't, what exactly was the message that was being sent?
Hi, Alison. I have to say, everybody is speculating when we are speaking about this assassination. We don't really know about the timing, about the opportunity. Sometimes things seem to be very timely, and then we realize that maybe this is an operation that has been in the works for months. We just don't know. But regardless of the motivation behind the timing, the fact that it happened now, whether it was planned to take place now because of the political circumstances, or whether it happened now because there was an opportunity, it did happen, like you said, at the end of the Trump presidency and as the world is transitioning towards the Biden administration. And that by itself does send a message. And the message it sends is that Israel, who, you know, according to the New York Times and other foreign sources, is responsible for this, wants to clearly signal that Iran is going to remain a top priority, and keeping the Iranian nuclear program from materializing is still Israel's number one priority here in the region, and that the Biden administration needs to think very well how it is going to manage the relationship with Israel on the one hand, and the relationship that Biden wants to fix or renew with Iran after the 4 years of Trump on the other hand.
Is this some way that Trump and Netanyahu are cooking up to tie Biden's hands, to influence his incoming foreign policy team?
There have been different analyses that I've read about this question. Even on our pages, there have been different suggestions. Is this good or bad for Biden as he goes to navigate the Iranian issue? Because some people will say, yeah, this is clearly an attempt to tie Biden's hands and to create a confrontation with Iran and to make the Iranians angry and looking for revenge. And then by the time Biden comes into the White House, the whole area is up in flames and it's much more difficult for him to negotiate. And I've seen other people suggest that maybe it works the other way around, that the Iranians are so angry right now with the Trump administration and are just counting the days until there is a change of power in Washington. And once Biden comes in, maybe he will have more leverage. So I think it will take time before we fully realize the impact that this will have on the Biden administration. And also, I want to say one thing about Biden in general. Throughout the election campaign, and it's true, this is now a policy issue, not a political issue. But throughout the election campaign, there were moments when people thought, is Biden going to fall into one of the traps that Trump was setting for him? Around issues of policing in the United States, criminal justice, and other circumstances, or the attacks on Hunter Biden. And Joe Biden has been a very disciplined campaigner for the presidency. He did not allow Donald Trump to set the agenda, to decide what should be discussed and what shouldn't be discussed. He had a very clear message about COVID and the economy and what he called the soul of the nation, and he stuck to it throughout the campaign. Will he be able to show the same level of discipline and concentration as a president-elect, while Trump, I think there was one analysis that Nolanda wrote on our website, is putting the world to flames, maybe with the help of Netanyahu.
Handing him the lighter.
Giving him the lighter. Will he be able, Biden, to keep that same level of discipline and basically say, I'm coming in 50 days and I'm going to focus on my priorities? If he does, maybe, 2 months from now, we won't look at this event as such a dramatic change in the American policy towards Iran.
Well, he's kept pretty much a similar team that he had in the campaign as his administration nominations for the senior positions come out. It's the same names as the people who are running his campaign.
And this team, not even one of them has responded to the assassination. We've seen people from the previous Obama administration denounce the assassination and attack Trump and basically use the same argument that Trump is trying to create some kind of a crisis in the Middle East to hurt Biden. But none of Biden's people have said that. They have all kept mum.
Can you talk a little bit about the nominations that have been announced that directly affect Israel? I think the most important is Anthony Blinken as Secretary of State and Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor. Who are these two guys and what's their past history with the Israel-U.S. relationship, and what do you expect looking ahead?
I think the main headline from the Israeli point of view is that this is not going to be a second Obama administration. This is going to be a Biden administration. Biden is not bringing back the band from the Obama days. Some of the people he is appointing have experience from the Obama administration or from the Clinton administration. Jake Sullivan was supposed to be a very high-positioned official in the Hillary Clinton administration that never came to be because of the 2016 election. But these are not Ben Rhodes and Dennis McDonough and Susan Rice. Mm-hmm. These are Valerie Jarrett, who were, the kind of like the what one Israeli official once called the radical group surrounding Obama. That's a quote, someone high in our government. So this is different. This is the centrist group surrounding Biden. Anthony Blinken, who was Biden's closest foreign policy advisor during the campaign and also during his days as vice president, worked with him in the Obama White House, but was Biden's foreign policy guy. He's someone that I think most Israeli officials, and you've written about this, Alison, you talked to some of the high-ranking Israelis who worked with him over the years. They see him as someone who's more center-left in his political orientation, clearly focused more on national security issues than on political fights. And is not someone that, let's say, a well-intentioned Israeli government should have any confrontations or serious conflicts with. Now, of course, when we talk about the Biden administration being more centrist and maybe more positive towards Israel than what others maybe expected, we also need to remember that Israeli politics will also play a role here. Today, we have a kind of center-right government here. Netanyahu and Likud are on top, and they've moved more and more to the right in recent years. But there is also a centrist element in the government with Kahol Lavan and Benny Gantz being the defense minister and Gabi Ashkenazi in the foreign ministry. And the security cabinet, where actually the foreign policy decisions are made, is more balanced. So that kind of government can probably get along okay with Jake Sullivan, Anthony Blinken, national security team in Washington. But if we have a change of government here and we see a pure religious right-wing government of Netanyahu and Naftali Bennett and then Likud people taking over all of the foreign ministry, defense ministry and other high-ranking positions, that kind of government will not get along with Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, even though they are not the, Obama team, even though they are Biden's team. And Biden himself said during the presidential campaign that he is concerned that Netanyahu has moved more and more to the right over the years, and he actually tied it to Netanyahu's legal troubles. There is a quote from Biden from December 2019.
Sounds like he reads Haaretz, right?
wouldn't surprise me. I'm sure Anthony Blinken reads Haaretz. Mm-hmm. But Biden actually said this in December 2019, said Netanyahu has moved more to the right, he's become more extreme because of his legal troubles. Now, that was before the formation of the weird unity government between Netanyahu and Gantz in March 2020. I don't know if Biden would say the same thing today. But when we talk about how the relationship will be managed, it's good from the Israeli point of view that this is not the Obama team, that this is the Biden team taking over in Washington. But we also have to remember that what happens politically here in Israel will have just as much of an impact.
So speaking of Iran and Donald Trump and Haaretz, Esther, in addition to being an amazing opinions editor and writer, you are also my go-to Twitter feed. And we had quite a Twitter moment at Haaretz over the weekend. Can you tell us about it and whether you see it as offering us some kind of clue as to the story behind this James Bond assassination?
Yeah, sure. So basically, Donald Trump retweeted Yossi Melman, who's an extremely well-connected and experienced analyst of the intelligence community who writes for us. The first tweet he retweeted was actually in Hebrew, which is, I think, you know, one of these historic moments.
You don't think Donald Trump reads Hebrew?
No. I actually spoke to Yossi last night just to kind of hear what the experience of being retweeted by Trump was. And basically what he was saying is that obviously it's clear that Trump knew that the assassination was in train on Friday. So his aides were kind of scoping around, seeing whom they could retweet without actually making an official comment by the US government itself.
Esther, I have to say that's kind of cute. You know, maybe you have the same. When I have a big story dropping and it's about to get published, you know, I wait for it on Twitter to see what are people going to say, who's going to share the link. So you're describing Trump basically sitting in the Oval Office.
I very much doubt it was him. But yes, they'd kind of probably prepared some kind of shortlist. If you see what happened, obviously the Pentagon and all of the official arms of the US government had no comment and no way they were going to comment. So the way for Trump to show his satisfaction about what had actually happened was to retweet Yossi and 60,000 other people as well. But what Yossi pointed out, which was quite entertaining, was that the Hebrew tweet that Trump perhaps read less carefully than the English one was a bit different from the English one. The English one said that it was a great blow to Iranian morale. And the Hebrew one said that, but it also said that Iran would certainly seek revenge. So really the messaging that Trump wanted was more in the English tweet than in the Hebrew one.
I'm sure he was really up on the distinction between the two tweets in the two languages, right? Esther, I did not bring you here only to discuss Twitter. You spend your days commissioning and editing opinion pieces in Haaretz, something that I'm sure has had to be a special challenge in the era of Trump and Netanyahu. And last week, you published a piece that you wrote. You don't write that very often, but when you do, it usually means you have something to say. The headline was, "No, you do not have to feel the Trump voters' pain." You took readers in it a little bit behind the scenes to see how the journalistic sausage is made and wrote, quote, "It is part of the ethos of liberal newspapers to offer a broad spectrum of views on its opinion pages. I'm proud to do that myself, whether my good faith is accepted or not." And then you added, quote, "It is not a requirement to adopt a quantitative ratio for pro-Trump views when the right-wing media ecosystem is so huge and it is vanishingly rare for liberals and leftists to appear in their prime editorial real estate." And you said, quote, "There is no shame for liberal newspapers to foreground the arguments that relate to their center and left politics. There is no shame when a newspaper endorses a candidate and that candidate wins to celebrate the win without offering participation trophies to the losing side and to enjoy success for the few nanoseconds before the left resumes cannibalizing itself." Wow. Well, first of all, great writing. And second of all, can you tell us a little bit about the experiences that led you to write this piece? What's it like to be an opinion editor at a left-leaning paper in this day and age, especially after some of the earthquakes we've witnessed at places like the New York Times?
Well, the first thing that I would like to say is that I think that being an opinion editor is the best job in the newspaper. And, you know, many days I feel sorry for people in lesser jobs, but I really, really
thanks a lot, Esther.
But what sparked this particular piece was a wave that started in my mind over election night, where you saw that the victimization narrative of the right started rising, which was already at quite a high point, but it started cresting in a way that I couldn't quite comprehend. But then how it was expressed was, this is all happening to us because we've been shut out of the public square, we've been censored, big tech and big media have a conspiracy to silence us. Well, this is all things that we've heard before, but the weird thing that happened quite soon afterwards, that quite a few people who certainly self-identify as liberals started echoing exactly the same points. It was almost like it was Yom Kippur rather than winning the election. They were saying that we have sinned. We have sinned against the right. We actually didn't listen to you. We are the elites that they say that we are, and that our victory is somehow tainted because we didn't reach out to them. And it went further than that to say we have to make amends, we have to give them more space for their views, we have to hug them and tell them we feel their pain. And then some even launched into the next stage, was a kind of Trump revisionism, that he wasn't actually that bad, and started, you know, talking about things that perhaps liberals need to learn from him. It was a strange sensation because we've all had 5.5 years of a constant barrage of Trump and his talking points. And what was most difficult was that Trump at that moment, and his supporters in the media, and still are right now, were saying that they had won an election they had lost, and that the votes that Democrats had put forward were worthless and shouldn't be counted. I mean, that is obviously the definition of disenfranchisement. So basically the argument was, we are not listening to the people who want to take away our right to vote. Is it the whole, it was very, it sounds weird, but actually these were, you know, debates that were happening not just on Twitter, but in opinion pages all around America. And on the one hand, of course, it's true that when nearly 50% of a country has a certain point of view, that their view should be represented in any media that considers itself liberal. You know, for instance, even here, the pro-Netanyahu press has an absolutely enormous advantage over, you know, what is basically a rump liberal media that remains here. But we still publish pro-Netanyahu or pro-Likud writers. But there has to be some kind of understanding about what an opinion piece is. It has to have an argument. It can't be a conspiracy. It has to say something new and thought-provoking. And as I said in the piece, we, you know, we've all gone to bed with Donald Trump and woken up with Donald Trump. So it's actually quite hard to invent the wheel and say something that doesn't sound just like the kind of agitprop that we hear from him quite often. And there's one other issue that I would say, which is the question of good faith and bad faith. I had an experience that I ran a pro-Trump op-ed, and then I ran a response to the piece a day later, which is a perfectly common, in mm-hmm. fact, essential kind of editorial journalistic practice. But the writer of the first piece was absolutely incensed that I had written, that I had run a response to them, and accused me of bad faith, and then a whole litany of all the favourite kinds of adjectives against Haaretz that the right like to use. And what worried me is, it at that moment I thought, well, we don't actually have a common understanding of what a free and fair debate actually is. You know, and that's my bread and butter. That is what an opinion section is. And there's just one more thing that I would add, is that, you know, it's very fashionable to talk about wokeness and cancel culture, and there definitely is something that is called the intolerant left. But much of my experience over the last few months has been that it's the right that wants to shut down debate and wants immunity from being questioned fairly.
Amir, you've got an interesting perspective, having worked at
center to right-ish publications in Israel, working at Haaretz, consuming the media in the United States. Do you agree with Esther's analysis?
I thought it was a really interesting article. I think it was also specifically interesting because it comes from Esther, and I know that it is important to her to publish voices from the right, and some of my favorite regular writers that she publishes, like Jonathan Tobin or Israel Einhorn, are writing from a right-wing perspective, and you know they get the best editing and the best promotion that Haaretz can give to an opinion writer thanks to Esther's work. And that's why when I saw the article, I said, oh, this is interesting, because I know of her commitment to giving, you know, broad range of opinion and bringing different voices. But I read it and I agreed with almost everything she wrote, frankly. I think there is a problem that maybe it happened because of how this election night played out, because there wasn't really a moment that people said, oh, you know, Biden has been declared the victory, this election is over, like we've seen in 2016 and 2012 and 2008 and even 2004. This was a very weird process in which on election night, Trump, in the first state that was called for a candidate, which was Florida, he really ran ahead of the polls and ahead of the expectations. And people started saying, wait a second, this is happening all over again. The media and the polls, they get it all wrong. Mm-hmm. And then the Trump voters go to vote and they actually come out in bigger numbers. And that began as a narrative from the studios and into the Twitter, Facebook universe and into the newspapers of we need to listen to these people. How did we miss them again? We didn't, you know, maybe we need to do cheshbon nefesh. As the results began to trickle in from more and more states and the slow, deliberate counting, and it was deliberate because Republicans in states like Pennsylvania, like Michigan, like Wisconsin, where they control the state legislators, intentionally refused to pass laws and amendments that would make the counting faster because they knew there would be a lot of mail-in voting because of the pandemic, and they refused to request from the local governors and secretaries of state to pass legislation that would allow a faster count. Mm-hmm. So as the results began to kind of bleed in, and it became apparent that Trump lost by 150,000 votes in the state of Michigan, where he won last time by 10,000 votes, that he lost by 80,000 votes in the state of Pennsylvania, that he won last time by around 45,000, and that he's the first Republican in more than two decades to lose Arizona and Georgia, and that even in the great state of Texas, a state that Republicans just a few election cycles ago won by 16-20%, he only won by 5%. As all of that became apparent, maybe the narrative should have shifted to, who are all these people that voted for Joe Biden?
Exactly.
And who are all these Republicans who voted for Joe Biden? Because we do see an interesting phenomenon in this election, that there was more ticket splitting in the sense of people who voted for Biden and for a Republican for Congress or Senate. We saw it in Maine, for example. You wrote about Maine.
Yeah. Saw a lot of people voting down ticket for Republicans but wouldn't vote for Trump.
Yes, exactly. And I think that should have been the debate. How did the media miss this trend? Who are these people? You know, in Maine that you covered, Alison, Susan Collins was reelected, mm-hmm. and the state went for Biden by, I think, 10%. It's a state that Hillary took by 3% last time. In New Hampshire, again, Biden won by 9 or 8%, a state that Hillary Clinton barely held on to last time. And at the same time, they reelected a Republican governor. So who are these people that are, you know, are Republicans in the sense that how they vote down ballot, but couldn't stomach a second Trump term? Maybe they're the ones we should listen to.
Esther, do you think that Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister here, do you think that other leaders in Europe and other parts of the world are watching this gaslighting / denial of reality / flouting of democratic norms by Trump and being inspired, feeling like they can get away with it, deciding that this means that they can push their boundaries? How much is Trump's behavior an American problem, an American phenomenon, and how much is it either a symptom or a cause of something more global?
No, it's a good question. I would say just on the Netanyahu thing, I don't think that Trump schooled Netanyahu. I think that Netanyahu's been, you know,
good at it for a while.
Really an expert at playing kind of on the boundaries of delegitimation of his political opponents for many, many years. And he did it with Arab citizens of Israel. He's done it with left-wing citizens of Israel. You know, there's you know, basically just a kind of a central core of the pure that he really considers to be legitimate. But I think that it clearly does obviously set a very public precedent to the world, because the US will always be accused of hypocrisy now. I mean, it's just, you know, there's no way of getting out of it. On the other hand, you know, populism and...
So you don't think Joe Biden can go back to the old way of saying, okay, not, you know, we're going to issue statements condemning the way this country's running their elections or that country's doing X, Y, or Z?
Well, sure, you can do some kind of repair work. There's no doubt about it. And it's obvious that if he's at the head of the government, then, you know, there's a completely different headwind blowing. But on the other hand, you know, these dynamics of how populism works in terms of demonizing parts of the electorate are far, far bigger than Trump as well.
Yeah. Amir, Donald Trump is floating the idea of announcing a 2024 presidential run on Joe Biden's inauguration day in January. Talk about trying to ruin his party, right? Well, whether or not this is actually factually true, it symbolizes something. Do you think the enduring specter of Trump is going to have an effect in the United States and in Israel? How Netanyahu will deal with Biden, how Israelis will deal with the Biden administration, how Americans will view Middle East policy or policy in general in the Biden White House. What's going to become of Donald Trump in the future, and how do you think it's going to affect this part of the world?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball to look at and foresee the future. I hope the media doesn't fall for it. That's all I can say, because Donald Trump is not going to be relevant for this kind of, you know, intense media coverage as he has received in the last 5 years, starting from January 20, 2021. And whether the media decides to play with the spectacle or not is going to make a big difference, because he's not going to have any more power, per se. And even in the Republican Party, It will take time before we see if he still has a hold on it or if new forces arise. But how the media, the American media, and also, you know, Haaretz and other international publications will choose to respond to these provocations will make a very big difference.
How fateful do you think this Georgia election will be, whether we have a Republican majority or a Democratic majority in the Senate? Do you think this will have a big effect on policy?
Of course it will, because if the Democrats can win both seats, then they have a majority. If they can win one, then Mitch McConnell has a very, very thin majority, and any one Republican senator, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, on a good day, Alisa Murkowski, can vote with the other side and make a big difference. If the Republicans win both seats, they still have a pretty narrow majority, but it's a different situation. They have more cards to play with and put pressure on Biden. So obviously this is all going to be very impactful for the fate of his presidency. But I also believe Joe Biden when he says that he will find ways to work with Republicans. It doesn't mean he will have to work necessarily with McConnell, but he will find ways to work with certain Republicans in the Senate. Again, you know, the immediate suspects that we mentioned, Romney, Collins, Murkowski, Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, who is retiring, and maybe one or two others. His whole political mantra for decades has been, you know, working and cooperating with people that he disagrees with. He was attacked for this trait during the Democratic primary. He was attacked by Kamala Harris, of all people, by the way, for working with senators who used to be, you know, segregationists and racists at the time. But at the end of the day, I think one of the reasons that Democrats gave him the nomination was because they wanted someone who is able to bring some, at least, cooperation back to Washington, and this will be his big test.
So we'll wrap this up with questions from a Haaretz analysis written by our colleague Anshel Pfeffer. Well, going back to Iran, let's ask ourselves, do you think this assassination was worth the risk if and when Iran decides to retaliate? And the second question is, will this move hurt us in terms of Joe Biden's future presidency? Will it cause his staff feeling like Netanyahu and Trump were playing these games during the transition? Will it make them trust Israel less, shut them out of consultations more than they would otherwise, having had enough of Netanyahu dictating U.S. policy? What do you guys think are the answers to Anshel's questions?
Well, I'm sure that the Biden administration, as Amir has, you know, explained, is quite au fait with how Netanyahu operates, and they're not naive. and what happens in the last month, it may be more dramatic, but, you know, there's no denying that Trump and Netanyahu have seen eye to eye on many significant regional issues. And the fact that there was drama in Friday, you know, there was drama 6 months ago and there was drama a year ago. So, you know, everyone likes to say it's like a script and everything's speeding up. Well, yes and no. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen in the next month. You know, crazy things could happen in the next month. And it's not like there's someone who is, you know, particularly calm and confident in the White House either. But on the other hand, you know, Netanyahu is not an idiot either. He's not going to throw away Israel's national security just to kind of go out with a bang.
Amir?
Well, I do want to mention that Iranian scientists were killed in all kinds of mysterious ways during the Obama administration as well. And in fact, the Obama administration pretty much told Israel, you guys can do anything you want to slow down the Iranian nuclear program as long as it doesn't lead us to actual war, which is, you know, for example, if Israel bombs the nuclear sites or if Israel instigates a revolution in Iran. Not that I think we are capable of, but if we tried. So I'm not sure the Biden team is going to look at this killing of a scientist and say, that's out of bounds for us. That's a different ballgame. Are they maybe pissed off that Trump is celebrating this like a child and again trying to, you know, use this to propel himself politically as he's fighting against the election results? Maybe. Do they think the timing is suspect and might be an attempt to sabotage? Perhaps. But at the end of the day, this doesn't seem to me like a move that is completely breaking the rules. And once the Biden team will come in and actually hold the levers of power, everything will change. And Netanyahu will have to work with them. I think he will want to work with them. And it will be a new game in town. We shall wait and see what that means.
Wait and see is the name of the game around here. Thank you so much to Esther Solomon and Amir Tibon, as well as producer Aaron Ehrlich. Join us again next time on Haaretz Weekly, and until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.